Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey everybody, welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here at the LA studio, right here in Central Hollywood. I came out for my annual jaunt to Max Fun Con at Lake Arrowhead, and I always try to squeeze in episodes, as you know by now. And this week I asked the great and the wonderful Alex Ferney to sit in with me. Alex, I actually met at Max Fun Con a few years ago, and he is one third of the comedy improv troupe Convoy out of UCB here in LA. And Convoy is one of the best, you guys. If you ever get a chance to check out Convoy when you're in LA, do it, do it, do it. Todd Fassen, Alec Berg, and Alex Ferney, just really thinking with a singular mind. Three really, really funny guys that have been doing this together for, geez, I think Alex said like 17 or 18 years now. Really, really have their craft down, and it's some of the best improv I've ever seen. So I met all those guys a couple of years ago there and kind of kept up in, with Alex over the years through Facebook and stuff. He's also a director. He directed a lot of episodes of Children's Hospital, one of my very favorite all-time comedies in TV history is Children's Hospital. It's just such a fun, silly show, and we got to talk a little bit about that as well, and a little bit about his background in performing for kind of a shy guy. It's another one of those cases of someone who was probably an introvert who found their voice on stage, and that's the case with Alex. And really good dude, great taste in films, very smart guy, and he picked the awesome Steven Soderbergh film from 1998, Out of Sight. We go back in time to when George Clooney was not even George Clooney, and Jennifer Lopez before she was J-Lo. And it's kind of hard to remember all those many years ago when they weren't big movie stars. So we talked about Out of Sight. We talked about Steven Soderbergh a lot and what a master craftsman he is. And we had a really good time. So here we go with Alex Ferney on Out of Sight. I do want to talk about, well, where are you from, first of all?
I grew up in New Hampshire.
Like Chicago.
Yeah. New Hampshire, but I lived kind of all over the Northeast. I grew up in New Hampshire, and then I lived in Rhode Island and a little bit in Boston and went to school in the Mid-Hudson. And so I just kind of say the Northeast.
Gotcha.
If I want to surprise people, I say I grew up on a horse farm, because I did.
Really?
And people wouldn't guess that from me. For like childhood, I lived on up every morning working horses. It was just a farm where there were some horses.
How many horses?
It ranged. Sometimes it was like three or four, but then at one point, I think when I was very young, there were like 14 horses.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who did what with them?
My mom grew up with horses and liked to ride them, and had some that like her dad had and stuff. And so that was mainly, I think, where they came from. I think some of them might have belonged to other people, because I don't know how we would have had 13 or 14 horses. But so we would hang out on this beautiful sort of farm that in the 80s my dad and probably my mom made into a sort of, I think, I would bet if we were to go back, it looks very like whatever Home and Garden magazine was in 1986.
This bucolic lifestyle.
Yeah. Those bleach wood wickery chairs everyone had with the bent metal, and then that I don't know what those are called, but everybody had them in the mid to late 80s, just listening to Graceland on them.
Are you still into horses?
No, I never was.
Really?
The other part of that was I was allergic to horses. It fucking sucks to grow up on a horse farm. So I would ride a little bit.
You're like, why is Alex always sick?
Yeah, just this little boy in a bubble. I was allergic to tons of stuff when I was a kid, and then I just grew out of it. But horses were the most annoying one, because on a horse farm. So I would ride a little bit, but I was never that good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I never cared enough. I was like a indoor kid pretty much.
Yeah.
But then my outdoor version of it was I would want to set my Ninja Turtles up in a tree as if it was a tree. You know what I mean? So
right.
It was less going around and riding. And I'm also exceptionally non-competitive. I'm not competitive.
Yeah.
And a big part of like horse riding was like, you go do these horse shows. And I don't like this. This is dumb.
Yeah.
You get a ribbon for like bouncing properly for the right amount of time. Right. Like, I don't even, this is unappealing.
I rode my first horse only like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And then I've only ridden once since then. And this is like walking through like a winery type of thing.
And that's kind of that. I think that's nice.
That's lovely. Fun,
yeah. They are. I think it's kind of interesting that they have such like the American mystique around horses and people bond with them, because they're also a lot of horses are so inbred, like that they are just the dumbest things.
Yeah.
Like people are like they're so soulful, but a good amount of horses are like big dumb dogs.
Yeah.
That like get scared by everything. You clap and they'll just like freak the fuck out.
Right.
Like, that doesn't seem like this human soul in a big body. That feels like a big dumb animal, because they are.
It still cracks me up that we use horsepower as the the reigning unit.
Had to make sense when it was like four. And you're like, wow, four horses. And now you're like, 60 horses at a certain point is just going to trip up each other. Yeah. That's going to be – it's a bell curve of what horses can do.
So you were an indoor kid. I imagine – I always like to talk to people about sort of their formative movie years.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have siblings and stuff?
I have a sister who's significantly younger than me. She's 5.5 years younger than me, which is like just enough to not – really, like, I wasn't old enough to take care of her, but we weren't ever, like, really ever at the same school or anything. We were around a lot. We have a good relationship, but it wasn't ever – we had no interest in common at any point.
Right. So who was I'm always interested in who was, like, where people get their culture from.
Yeah.
Like, who was feeding you, if anyone?
Early on, like, going to a movie was a huge treat.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably – my mom never really liked going out to movies or anything, and – every now and then my dad would.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember him doing one of those. They would do like those Columbia House, but for VHSs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I can remember him doing that one point and getting like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Oh, wow.
I'm trying to remember what else there would have been. But it was like every now and then there would be, I think Bad News Bears was one of them.
Oh, God, so great.
And it was like those sorts of things. I remember watching that. But I don't know. I got really into movies in like high school. But before then, before I moved to Rhode Island, it was like the movies I can remember watching besides like of course, Little Mermaid was as a kid became obsessed with Back to the Beach. Have you ever seen Back to the Beach?
No.
In retrospect, I haven't watched it in years.
I think I know. Was it the like Annette Funicello throwback?
In the 80s. It's almost,
I know what you're talking about.
Not quite, but it's almost what Wet Hot was to like the 80s camp movies to Beach Blanket Bingo, but without it being like David Wayne and Showalter. So it is, there are jokes, but it's not, you know, there are jokes.
Right.
But like Pee Wee Herman shows up and sings the bird, like bird, 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 bird is the word.
Wow.
And like Fishbone and Annette Funicello do a song called Jamaican Ska, which is
Fishbone.
Yeah, it is really something. They filmed it, you know, I think not far from here, but I would rent it all the time. And like, it's this weird camp movie that as an adult, I was like, hey, how did I find that?
Yeah.
And why? And my poor parents.
Right.
Like, that's all that I would watch.
Well, they were probably into the original Beach Blanket Bingo stuff.
I don't think they were.
No.
I think they were just like, fuck, our kid found this movie that he is referencing movies he's never heard of.
Allergic to horses.
Yeah, he just sits inside, watches this, and doesn't finish Super Mario Brothers. That's all he does.
So you were kind of in charge of your own cultural consumption?
Probably, yeah. It was very – I was like a quiet and shy kid. It was a long time before I kind of like came out of a shell. And I would – you know, watch a decent amount of TV, play a decent amount of video games, do a lot of like drawing and playing with like action figures, a lot of, I didn't have a ton of friends, so I would like read like the old Marvel role-playing game books, but not ever be able to play it because there's no one to play with, like that sort of stuff. And then with movies, my parents were always, the only movies I can remember being told I couldn't see were Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and then later Terminator 2. I don't know. Indiana Jones, I makes sense. It did burn into my kid brain. It's like, this must be the scariest movie ever. And then I saw it, and I was like, oh, yeah, okay. I guess at the age, it was right to be like, hey, this is largely about child slavery, and then someone's heart gets pulled out. But then Terminator 2 was weird. I don't know why my parents or my mom was like, you can't see this one. And I did at a sleepover.
Right.
But that was like the only one I can really remember being like, this might be too violent. But then I would – like that was the only one. So that faded away very, very fast.
Well, when did you get into performing as a shy kid?
I can – there was a like a every year in my – the second elementary school I went to. So I went to this school in fourth and fifth grade, and they would do every year like this sort of like themed show. Mm-hmm. And one year – and like everyone would do it. And one year the theme was I want to say space. I think it was space because there was like – we sang Age of Aquarius and nice. Like there's like a dance to Starman by Bowie.
Oh, wow.
So I think it was space. But in that, and they dress all the kids up, and because Age of Aquarius, all the kids dress like hippies. And like, I guess I get like really into it to the point where people are like, who is that kid in the wig who's like really excited about it? And it was me.
Wow.
And it like surprised all the teachers because I was just this quiet little nerdy kid. And then I started doing plays, and I did plays in middle school, and then I started doing improv in high school, and I moved to Rhode Island, and like those plays, like those middle school plays, which I'm sure were just god awful, kind of helped me. That's how I sort of learned how to perform, and I still think in a lot of ways, like on stage is the easiest place to be. It's still much easier for me to even like introducing a show or something. There's still like a element where like this is way easier than just initiating a conversation with
him. Right. So were you like legit acting in plays? Were they like dramas and stuff like that?
No, yeah, legit acting would be generous. Like in high school, like we did Inherit the Wind.
Yeah.
You know, like, so like the high school sort of stuff. Uh-huh. And I'm sure I took it very seriously. Like we did the Pajama Game, and inexplicably we did Camelot, which is ambitious for a high school production.
Yeah.
And then in college, I did some like quote unquote like real plays, but then I think also it was like, oh, I think comedy is my thing, improv and sketch are my thing.
So what does high school improv look like?
Whose line is it anyway?
Like, really?
But with squeaky voice 16-year-olds. Yeah, I moved in when I was, I guess I was 16. So when my mom got remarried, we moved to Rhode Island from New Hampshire. And I went to this like artsy fartsy kind of like private school. Uh-huh. And I coming from a public school. And again, I was still very shy, but like I still, a couple kids like on the second day, these basically theater kids were like, oh, hey, you should come and do this improv club with us. Mm-hmm. Like, it was very nice of them just to be like, hey, this kid is new.
Right.
Come do this thing. And then a bunch of them were like my friends all the way through. And I did that throughout high school and then into college. And I'd seen Whose Line Is It Anyway? And I'd seen some live improv and I liked it.
So right.
I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll try that. I would love to have a tape of that. It was a club. Like, I think in the first year, like, you didn't really perform. You were just like, go do improv in this basement room.
So it's almost like training?
Kind of, but I wasn't even like, no notes. It's just, this is a fun thing to
right.
do. So it was like, it wasn't even really about performing. It was just sort of like, we like this thing. Well, let's do it and probably do it badly without even like an eye to getting better. Just sort of a purely just to do this thing almost as a social element, which is very, like, I haven't actually thought about that in a little while, like how unusual that is.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of interesting and kind of it was cool to do, because also then there was no real being bad at it, because who the fuck cares.
When did you first start, like, when did it get serious for you as far as like, hey, I really want to like start something?
Late in college.
Is that where you met the guys?
Yeah, I met Alex Berg and Todd Fassin. We all went to Vassar College together.
Okay.
And we all did improv together, and we did some sketch together and that sort of stuff. And I was a history major. I was going to be a theater major. And then I took like a semester's worth of classes. And I was like, a lot of these people I can't spend 4 years with. They're so serious.
Yeah.
Like just no humor or joy. So I was like, this is going to make me not want to do this at all. So I switched to history, which I'd been thinking about anyways. And then I would do sketch and improv, and we would perform. And at Vassar, if you've ever been to Poughkeepsie, New York, it's a little bit nicer now, but when we were there in the early 2000s, I mean, like, it was a mill town.
Uh-huh.
Everyone went south and it just remained. And it was like, parts of it were like burned out. It was like not a great place. So people at the college just stayed on campus.
Right.
So there wasn't a lot to do outside. So people would just happily come and bring 40s and drink at this college. We were the only improv team, and they would come and watch.
Wow.
And so we would do it there and started to get like good is probably too generous, but like confident, you know? And then my end of my junior year, a friend that we performed with kind of convinced me and Berg to move out here and be like, well, let's do like improv and sketch and write and see if we can do something. And I had never thought about it here being LA. And so we did.
Now, was that like did you always want to have career aspirations in the industry?
No, I would have probably, were it not for that conversation, I probably would have moved to New York after college, and I probably would have just like made my way into more schooling. I probably would have followed history because I do love that.
Really?
Yeah. And I don't know where that would have gone. I didn't have any like, oh, I'm going to be a lawyer.
Right.
A lawyer, but I would have been this. I probably would have been exceptionally happy teaching history. That probably would have thrilled me.
My parents were both teachers, and I always sort of had that bug, I think.
Yeah. My mom is a teacher of like little kids, but it just seems, that seems fulfilling to me. So I probably would have stumbled that way. I think I thought about it, but I honestly don't think I could have ever done it. I think I just didn't think that was like – I didn't think I was ever going to be like good enough, or even if I was, like how'd you do – it's impossible, at least for me, to be at 21 being like – and then you go and you make things and people pay you to be – that seems crazy to me.
So you guys have been performing together, the three of you, for how long now?
Probably since, I think all three of us together since 2001.
Wow.
Long time. So college.
Well, that explains a lot.
Yes.
Because, man, I mean, I haven't seen the most improv in the world. I've seen enough, though, to know that you guys is like some of the best shit I've ever seen.
Thank you.
It's just, it was so like, it was just so tight and like, so rarely do you feel that. That one brain thing coming from multiple people.
Yeah, we know. I think, you know, knowing each other for as long as we do is very helpful.
Yeah.
Because we can kind of be birds of a feather. And also there's, I think, there's an element of like when you know people that well that like you can – A, there's just no – there's never going to be a sense of panic.
Right.
Because I trust Berg and Todd to – we're never, it's not going to fall apart.
Right.
It might not be the best show we've ever done, but
right.
we can find it. We can fix it.
Uh-huh.
And like that is, I think all those like high school and college shows helped me when I moved out here in my early 20s just to, all three of us to have like a certain level of confidence in like, well, I think this is funny, so I want to do this thing.
Yeah.
And if other people don't think it's funny, that's okay.
Yeah.
And I think that that is something that it takes a while to learn. And I think I was lucky to learn it early.
Are you guys at the point now where you, I mean, imagine after that many years together, there's got to be some, like, not messing with each other, but, like, sort of, like, it can't get stale. So, like, you are you pushing each other as a threesome?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I mean, I'm sure we fall into, like, ruts, and I'm sure there's stuff like, oh, Convoy's doing that again. But, like, I think all three of us are probably – each individually our own individual worst critics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all get – if we start to get bored, we'll have conversations about it. And we'll go, yeah, you know what? This is like – let's try to mix it up in this way. Sometimes just in like real like improv in the weedsy ways. And sometimes – this is a few years ago now, but we do our show every week at UCB. And we're like, well, let's just once a month do this entirely different thing. Our show is normally like very fast and like lots of scenes. So once a month we do a show that's just the whole show is one scene.
Yeah.
And like that, we were in like a little bit of a rut at that moment that like bumped us out of it, just doing something
that's
new.
Cool.
And I think
like push each other and
yeah. And I also think like none of us are quote unquote successful, which I think also helps because like this thing's, we can't fully coast on sometimes very easy when you're a famous person or like people like, yeah, I fucking, no matter what you do,
right,
we're going to reward it.
Yeah.
And what that's not even a like comment on the people. That's just what a siren song.
Yeah.
If you know something's going to work, it's real fucking hard not to do it.
Yeah. You guys have a good following here though.
Yeah,
I would imagine.
Yeah. It's, I mean like I feel like in improv nerd world here in LA, people probably, I would hope like us.
Yeah. A lot of respect for Convoy in the improv nerd world.
I would hope so. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about Children's Hospital, which, you've directed.
That's right.
Quite a bit, right?
Or, the last two seasons, I did, I think 6 episodes in total,
Just one of my favorite shows, and Like, when did you start directing? How did that come about?
That came about very accidentally. I got hired by Funny or Die as a writer because of an improv, because whoever hired me saw improv shows I was in, which I think is a weird thing to assume. Well, you can probably write, but it was also like, whatever. At that point, Funny or Die, there was no structure to it whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It was just like rooms where people like made web videos, and it was in that moment where it was still like, what? An actual famous person did a video on the internet.
Right.
Like,
so
that's how Funny or Die worked. And because of that, there was no structure whatsoever. And when I got hired on, I got hired as a writer. And then like within a week, I was like, oh, nothing will ever get made that I write unless I direct it.
Right.
Because everyone's just kind of on their own there.
So you just got to like be your own advocate.
Yep. So I just started like being like, okay, this will be me teaching myself how to do this thing.
Uh-huh.
And like I'd shot like little sketches on my own that looked like garbage and stuff. And so I started doing that and was there for 3 years. And then over that amount of time, like the way I was able to kind of like jump out of Funny or Die and start doing like, you know, stuff like NTSF and Children's Hospital was basically I'd done some shorts with Paul Scheer.
Uh-huh.
And then
I had Paul in here last year.
He's great.
He's awesome.
Nice. He really, really helped me by bringing me over to work on myself and Nick Weiger to work on his show that he used to have called NTSF, which is like a like cop procedural kind of spoof. And so I wrote a couple of those and then directed a couple of those in its last season. And then, you know, that's a very small, like, Children's Hospital and NTSF and, Hot Wives and all those shows are all very, a lot of similar faces and people involved.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of like how I got into that.
Now, did you write any Children's Hospital or is that scripted?
Yeah, that's scripted.
It is?
Yeah. And it's pretty like obviously you have like Ken Marino or something. It's going to be like, oh, yeah, you beat it? Great. Then we're going to go with that.
Ken's my hero.
Yeah, he's very funny.
I've asked him 4 times to be on the show through his people. Yeah. And it's sort of like my annual plea. I'm like, hey, it's me again. Well, not annual, I guess, because I haven't been doing this that long. I guess biannual plea.
Sure.
Hey, it's Chuck again. And they're like, oh, hey, Chuck. They're like, he wants to do it, but like it just hasn't worked out for one reason or another.
He's great. He intimidated the hell out of me. So season I had done – like I weirdly just through different ways have like met different members of the state and I like watching the state when I was growing up, which is great. But like Ken, for some reason, just like his energy is so – he's got big energy.
Yeah.
And like it intimidated me so much. And then from working with him on Jones, I was like, oh, he's really nice. He's like being very nice and generous.
That's good to know.
Like spooked of him.
Yeah. He's one of the guys that like where you're talking about like anything that someone says is funny.
Yeah.
Like I can't – nothing he does doesn't just slay me.
Well, and he's also – part of it is I think children's works and I can take literally zero credit for it because it worked before me and it continued to work while I was there. But what children is like in the kindest way, so many of the jokes are so dumb.
Oh, it's the best dumb show.
And the cast is so good.
Yeah.
Everyone on that cast is an incredible actor.
Yeah.
And none of them play it anything besides the fact that they're incredible actors. So Ken is a great actor and Lake obviously is a great actor. And Aaron and Cordry are all so good that
Megan Mullally. I mean, are you kidding me?
They just throw the Hubel, they all throw themselves into these things and it makes it work so well because it doesn't, it's winky, but it never feels like, we just fucking like made this thing.
Yeah.
You know, it always feels like we took this seriously, even though it was insane schedules and no one's like making a ton of money and everything. And it started as a web series just during the strike.
Oh,
and they were just like, let's make a thing.
Yeah.
And then it turned into something where it is, they could get away with it being like honestly half as good and people would still be like, I love it.
Yeah.
And I think it was like, I'm so happy I got to work on it.
So good. And there's something about that 15 minute show length. That it's just the amount of jokes you guys fit in and arcs, like story arcs. It was just like, as a writer, it's really like super impressive to see.
It was really, one of the episodes I got to do in the last season was like called Cy Gets Tenure. And it was Cy Gets Tenure, which doesn't make any sense at a hospital. Yeah. And like what's going on in that episode is It feels like an hour long because Henry Winkler gets tenure, so he invents a jetpack.
Right.
Meanwhile, Rob Hubel has stolen a DJ gig from Cordry somehow, and his life is spiraling out. And Megan Mullally is stuck on the go-go pedestal, like that everyone's forgotten about her, and she has to like hunt rats for food. And it's 12 minutes long.
It's nuts.
And it's so insane. Yeah. I don't remember who wrote that one, but the fact that like it all worked and clicked. And then there's still room for bonkers side jokes, like that just come out of nowhere. It's not all peace moving. Like, they had that down to a real science on that show by that last season.
Was that Cordry's baby to begin with? Or
Cordry and Wayne, I think, and John Stern is one of the producers.
Yeah,
like that. They all were during that writer's strike when they were just like, we're going to just make this thing for us.
Right.
Like was it during the strike? I forget. But that was they're all their sort of thing.
I think that spirit kind of carried through where like, you know, it's a show where no one's getting rich on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of these people are big stars and like legends, Henry Winkler, for God's sakes. And you could just sense the fun and the sense of play.
Because there would be no point. If you didn't want to be there, why would you do this?
Yeah.
You know, like sometimes it'd be like, well, because you're making a gazillion dollars. That's why you're here.
Yeah.
And this was like, honestly, long days. And typically like.
It was a very ambitious show.
Rushed. Yeah. And it usually looked like $1 million. It looked great.
It looked awesome. Where do you guys shoot that?
The first three seasons before I was involved, it was at the Scrubs Hospital.
Okay.
Then they tore the Scrubs Hospital down. Maybe it was the first three or four. Then there's a season that like is basically a MASH play where they're working out of like tents.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the fifth season, we were in a plastics like factory in Simi Valley, I think. And then the last season, it was in this like building, this like beautiful brutalist building that you drive by on the 101 that used to be the Sunkist building. Now I don't know what's there. And they would just
build
these sets on the inside of spaces that had no business looking that good. And and I think also because it was such a parody of these TV shows, those TV shows don't look real. They never look like real hospitals.
Right.
so it was helpful to then go like, oh, well, I'm not bumping because, that I buy that as much as I buy Grey's.
Right. You know? So good. What's it like? I mean, to walk on that set as the director, that's got to be pretty intimidating.
It's helpful that, like, it's all very nice people. It was intimidating, especially because a lot of those people are people that I had watched and liked.
Sure.
You know, like again, the state, David Wayne and Ken. And also, like Henry Winkler, which is insane.
He directed Henry Winkler.
But he is also so nice. That it was like intimidating until you're there, and then it's so fast that you're just doing it, and
you don't have time to be scared.
you just kind of make decisions and go with it.
Yeah.
And I think because, you know, people were like very like sort of like open and collaborative and everything, you like punch stuff up and people would like chime in. I was like, what about this? And I think like that's how I like to work. I like to be super collaborative. And so that was very, very good. And like pretty quickly you're like, oh, this is fun.
Right.
I like this. Yeah, great. No problem.
No,
and it was very similar to NTSF in how it was shot and the type of show it was and like the speed and everything.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Mm-hmm. What are your ambitions for directing?
I've always like, again, like as a performer and then a writer and as a director, it's always been like writing is more fun for me. And so like the goal would be to get to sell something that I've written that I get to just make as well. Specifically, honestly, more in TV, like, I was just talking about this on another thing, but I did a low budget movie that then just like disappeared from existence. Like
you directed one?
That we shot in Vancouver, and then the company that produced it, like everyone I know who worked there left while we were in post, and I don't even have a copy of it.
No.
It's going to go on streaming everything. And so like that was interesting. It was very educational for me to do that and see how that was different than TV. But ideally it would be something that like, either I or me and Berg and Todd or something like that would create this like, oh, this is what we think is funny.
Right.
And then I can kind of see that all the way through. That would be my ideal. Because I've always – everything I've done so far has been like helping people make their thing.
Right.
Which is great. And I love that. But it would be fun to have other people help me make my thing.
Right. TV or film?
I think if you – I honestly think if you were like, hey, you can do a season of a TV show or make a movie, I think I'd probably go TV show because I think I could I think I would have more – I'm more confident I could do that well, right?
Okay.
Like I think I could probably do a good movie I hope I can.
Uh-huh.
But I think I could see more likely the path to being like, hey, that was a good TV show. I also think maybe part of that is I can just I feel like – the chances of anybody seeing any given movie that is made is so low.
Yeah.
Unless it's, unless Captain America is doing something.
It's interesting. It's like, it's never been a better time as far as like, there's so much out there, but it's also the hardest time to get anything seen.
And there's like great stuff out there too. There's obviously garbage and there's obviously great stuff, just like Forever. But I don't know how you... I honestly have no idea how you get people to see a movie that isn't
right.
Like I saw Booksmart. Booksmart's great.
Yeah.
It's super, super fun. And people talked about it and it was good and it like didn't make a ton of money. You know, uh-huh. But to me, I was like, Booksmart should have been a big old hit, you know? And every now and then you find like, for whatever reason, John Wick has become a whole cultural phenomenon because it's really well done. I was like, it happens.
Yeah.
Where no one knows what John Wick, what the fuck is this? And then I was like, it's good.
And that wasn't very, budget-wise for what it was.
Couldn't have been,
That first movie was not a very
big
budget.
And I remember the ads being like, this looks like everything.
Yeah.
You know, why would I, I like Keanu Reeves fine, but I'm not going to rush out. And then you start hearing about how good it was. And then now we got a fourth one coming.
I just saw the first two. I was very late. So I just saw those like a month ago.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, I'll watch the John Wick movies.
Yeah.
And I was like, these are fucking great.
Yeah. You think it's going to be
so much fun.
I think, cause I remember assuming when people were talking about it, I was like, this is the way I'm not knocking Fast and the Furious, but the way people love that and talk about that,
right.
Those are basically Marvel movies and they're big and silly and fun.
Yeah.
And then the craft to the John Wick movies is like insane. Like did you see the third one?
Not yet.
There is a knife fight that is very early on that is like Buster Keaton. Like it is just, they keep heightening it without ever tipping over.
Right.
And you're just sort of like, I don't understand how you craft and plan something, especially at the speed it's going on.
Those are stunt guys, right?
It's like
stunt coordinators.
It's all stunt. It's dudes I'm sure they boarded out, which is why the stories make no sense.
Yeah. Like, you don't see John Wick for the,
he's the got to do this lines. Thing. And you're like, okay.
Yeah.
And then he does it.
Yeah.
And then like the end with a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And it works. It's great. Cause do I want a bunch of that? It's like, no, it's like some fun world building, amazing fighting and stunts and stuff, but I don't need to be like, okay, his dog died and he is sad.
Yeah. That's all you need to know.
Full stop. Uh-huh. Let's not mix it up.
I did think all the world building, that was something that surprised me that I did not know was a part of that. And it's just like, that's one of the coolest parts of it to me.
Yeah. They do a bunch of it in the third one too.
Yeah. I heard it just gets even sort of deeper and deeper.
And for some reason, sometimes that would annoy me where I'm like, yeah, you're on ass. And this I'm like, I think we're all having fun. I think everybody knows exactly what's going on and no one's being like, here's what John Wick is saying about the world. I think they'd be like, what's the most fun?
It was almost one of those movies where afterward, like you and your friends look at each other and you're like, That was great, right? Like, who's the first one that's going to admit that we fucking love that?
Yeah. And the fact that the movie just goes like, all the world building, it presents like you already know it.
Right.
And I love that. Where they're trying to be like, okay, and if you make a swear, you have to cut your thumb on this thing and hand over this pendant. And they do it like, obviously this is something all people know. You all know this. We don't want to waste time explaining it. So anyway, here he did the thing. And you're like, wait. What is that? You've never mentioned that before. What is this? And you're like, sure, I guess. Okay.
Right. It's like, did I fall asleep for a second?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Out of Sight.
Great.
I think the entryway here, maybe we should chat about Soderbergh for a minute.
Yeah.
I grew up, I'm older than you, so I was like, I saw Sex, Lies, and Videotape when it came out.
Yep.
And King of the Hill and Kafka and like all these early, The Underneath, which is just so great and like criminally underseen. And he was like the indie guy.
Yeah.
And then I was looking at his filmography today. He did all those early films, Schizophilus, which is just crazy, and then Grey's Anatomy. And then all of a sudden, he explodes with maybe one of the best like five movie runs.
It's insane, that run.
Out of Sight, The Limey, which
is very, very
I can't
good.
Wait for somebody to pick The Limey, one of my favorite movies. Yeah. Aaron Brockovich, Traffic, and then Ocean's 11.
Yeah. I think that is – he is
– and this was within like 8 years or something
so
crazy.
It's so fast. And it's like also at a time when like the industry was starting to change because he's straddling 2000 there. It's the early, late 90s into the early 2000s. Uh-huh. And those movies are so good. And he is he's one of those directors where like when it doesn't work – mm-hmm. It doesn't work because he wasn't trying something. You know, it doesn't work, but there's an interesting attempt there.
Right.
And like he is so
he's never phoning it in.
He's never phoning. He's always trying something. Mm-hmm. And I would argue in a like, for the most part, like deeply non-pretentious way.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not that sort of like, well, hell, we only did it with, like, we only used the microphones available in 1940. Like,
right.
Okay, I don't care. But it's always something in the actual final film that he's trying to do, even when he's breaking down in these weird, like, what is a movie? I'm going to make this thing where you have to go on an app and everything.
Right.
Like, I find him fascinating. And I think Out of Sight is like, is just, I think it's perfect.
Yeah.
In how like fresh it feels, but also being like, it's a cops and robbers story.
Yeah, it's a cops and robbers story. But it's also like the relationship, like that's the undercurrent of the film.
Yeah,
is this super hot relationship?
Incredible.
It's just like one of the most like scintillating scenes in movie history. Is that couple of scenes, the trunk scene.
Yeah.
And then the bar scene.
Yeah. And I think like those scenes are, you know, like it's been said a million times, but the bar scene is like the you're learn how to edit, just watch this for the rest of your life. It's so beautifully done.
Yeah, the way he crawled. And was he editing his stuff then or
I forget if he was at that point or if he had so
he used fake names, right? And he like shot his own movies and edited his own movies.
So I've always lost track of like who's a real person and who's just also Steven Soderbergh.
Yeah, exactly.
I think there was I think he had an editor who came up with the cross cut. Like I think there were certain things there. But like those there's so many things about the movie that I love that I stumble over my words. But like those two scenes in particular, which are, I think, fucking incredible. And they each, they're a movie apart, beginning and end. And they make each other work in a way that is incredible. Where that first trunk scene, if someone hasn't seen it, he's breaking out of prison. Him being Jack Foley is played by George Clooney, and his buddy's picking him up. And just by a fluke, Marshall is there. Karen Sisko, played by Jennifer Lopez, who is great.
She's great. I mean, this was pre-J-Lo. This is when she was Jennifer Lopez.
She is so good in it.
Yeah, and proof that when she has the material, she's really, really great.
And she accidentally shows up, sees them breaking out, pulls a gun, and one thing later, they grab her and put her in a trunk and with him hiding out. So they're like kind of crammed together in
like
this trunk.
Spooning each other.
Yeah, and there's a way in which this is gross because it's played romantic and it's played sexy and be like, hey, this dude just grabbed a woman and shoved her in the trunk and we're trying to be like, how sexy? Like, okay, so that could be troubling. And then that second scene comes at the bar later where they meet up at this bar and for the first half of the scene, they're kind of doing this role play thing, pretending to be someone else because she's a cop and he's a bank robber.
Very kind of old school movie making.
Yeah.
Like it felt like Bogey and Bacall or something.
And it just writes the power. Like it just, anything about that trunk scene, you're like, no, this is mutual and this is real. And like, she honestly wasn't ever in danger.
Yeah.
Like I just think it's so smart the way they do that. And in that first scene too, the way it's shot is they're in the trunk. You don't get a ton of angles.
Yeah.
So they've got all this red light.
Yeah,
it's just above them and it just holds.
Uh-huh.
And then you go to that bar scene and it's like she's sitting there. They've kind of fallen in love from afar and these like douchebags keep hitting on her.
That part is great too.
Very funny. God, and she just misses them one by one. And again, she's incredible. And then he comes up and pretends to be like a douchebag and she plays along and they have this whole conversation and it's held in this like two shot against the snow falling outside this window.
So beautiful.
And it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And like those, like the, just the confidence to hold what he holds. Also with two, honestly, like, untested actors.
Yeah, I mean,
even Clooney.
You kind of forget this is 98, and I read the Ebert review, and it said something about, like, you know, forget ER. Like, yeah, this is his, like, he's going to be a movie star.
Soderbergh made, I think, single handedly made George Clooney a movie star.
Yeah, and he was, I didn't know that, but he was attached to this film when the property came to Soderbergh, and Soderbergh was kind of like, I don't know, man, I'm not sure about this. And apparently, like, the head of the studio said, hey, kid, listen. Yeah. Opportunities like this are not going to come your way a lot. Like, you really need to think about this.
Yeah. It's so, like, that is one of the many things I think is great about Soderbergh is, like, his ability to work with actors.
Because,
mm-hmm, like, until that moment, like, Clooney is a TV actor.
Yeah.
Because I think he had done One Fine Day before, a fun little rom-com with Michelle Pfeiffer.
Oh, right.
But he's in ER mode.
Yeah.
You know, and he's, like, kind of, he's filming for a small screen.
Yeah, a little sort of mid to late 30s.
Yeah.
And just this man.
And then he does this, and you're like, and again, like, I get excited. Like, Soderbergh made George Clooney a loser. Jack Foley is a loser.
He is. And he's kind of doofy. Like, in the trunk scene, it's kind of cute because she's the one that knows its network.
Yeah.
And she's the one that knows is Peter Finch.
Yep.
And she knows that he got the quote wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to take any more of your shit. Yeah. And she kind of laughs at him. And she's just been thrown in a trunk with this, this, like, you know, escaped convict.
And she knows
convict.
She's got a gun that just out of reach that she's about to grab.
Right.
Like, there's so much going on there.
Yeah.
And he plays a loser without – a lot of times when movie stars play losers,
mm-hmm,
you get the vibe of, like, can you believe if people didn't like me?
Yeah, yeah.
And in this, I believe that George Clooney is a fuck-up.
Yes.
He's also around bigger fuck-ups. Steve Zahn is so funny in this movie. And
getting started on Glenn.
Glenn is incredible. Like, it is so good.
Oh, man.
I'm just jumping around.
Well, the cast in this movie is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, you've got Farina.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Michael Keaton in a –
playing the same role he played in Jackie Brown. Brown. They are in the same universe.
Let me ask you. You got one that says undercover?
It's incredible.
So many great lines. Yeah. But then you have Ving Rhames. You, mm-hmm, have Steve Zahn. Mm-hmm.
Cheadle.
Got Cheadle, like maximum Cheadle,
yeah,
in this movie. And then just, like, throw in Albert Brooks, for Christ's sake.
Yeah. It's so insane. And it is – like, I'm also a – I saw this in high school, and I saw it twice in the theaters.
Uh-huh.
And I think I saw it because I've always really loved Elmore Leonard's books.
Yeah.
And this is based on it, as is Jackie Brown, which is based on a book called Rum Punch.
Right.
And those are my two favorite adaptations, two of the only good ones. The only other, like, good ones are the show Justified and Get Shorty is a different thing, but it works.
Yeah, Get Shorty is one of my
very fun
top tens. Yeah.
But, like, this vibe of criminals are dumb. There's that,
yeah,
I forget the exact quote, but that Elmore Leonard thing of being like, no one becomes a criminal if you're smart. Like,
right.
Like, so he writes criminals as believably stupid.
Uh-huh.
And that's normally what adaptations of his stuff fuck up. They make them goofball central, you know?
Yeah.
And this, you believe everyone, like, the most cartoonish is Steve Zahn, and God, he's funny in it. they make the point of he has a horrifying scene.
Steve Zahn, when he has to kill
Don
the guy?
Cheadle makes him kill somebody. And it is, like, tastefully done, and it's all on Zahn's face. And until then, you're like, oh, he's the goofy stoner. And
right.
The scene happens, and you're like, oh, I'm sympathetic now to this guy. And it's like there's not a frame of the movie I would change.
Yeah, I mean, the sympathy for these characters, like, you want – like, Clooney is a loser, but he's also kind of slick.
Yeah.
Like, he walks that line perfectly. Like, that first robbery where he walks in and he just kind of – he robs it on a whim, we find out later on after he leaves Ridley's place and doesn't – you know, gets offered the security guard job and then just fucking decides to go in there and rob that bank with nothing.
Yeah. And I think there's a thing in the book where, like, he's robbed all these banks but he's never used a gun. Like, I think that's, like, his – I think in the book –
well, he kind of says something about that. Because at the end when he does use the gun, it's clearly the first time he's ever, like, shot someone.
Yeah. And it's so – and, I mean, the climax of the movie is him trying to die.
Yeah.
He's trying to get her – he doesn't want to go back to prison. He's, like, this lifer and he doesn't want to be a loser and he would rather die.
Is that why he puts the mask back on, you think?
Yeah.
To make it easier for her?
To make it easier for her. To be like – because – and – The I think truly the Scott Frank wrote it, I believe.
Yeah.
And there is a thing in that where I don't know, you can never tell really what comes from where, but it's a combination of script and directing
mm-hmm.
where there's these moments that happen throughout the movie where it freezes on a random frame.
Yeah, great
freeze frames. And it fades away and moves away. Like him throwing the tie.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a time jump, but sometimes it's just a freeze uh-huh. and it'll continue on. It happens during the bar scene.
Yeah, yeah.
And you, it just feels like a stylistic choice. You're mm-hmm. like, okay, we're being cute. And then in that final – in that scene where he pulls the mask down,
mm-hmm.
like it all comes together where he says no more timeouts.
Right.
And they have that conversation in the bar too where he's like, well, let's just call timeout, and they sleep together.
Right.
And then they go their separate ways. But at the end he says no more timeouts.
Yeah.
We just have to kind of keep living. And like that dialogue coming back and addressing why they had made this choice – I think is so good. Like you watch it again and you're like, oh, these are all these big moments in this person's life.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's just going like, no, we don't get that. Now this is real. Like I can't do this anymore. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah. There's another callback that I'd never realized before either is about the midway point. Ving Rhames says something about, you know, you don't have a choice when you got a gun on you. And Clooney says, you still have a choice.
Yeah.
And that's like the whole thing at the end, you know?
Yeah.
You still have a choice even when that gun's on you.
It's like, it's
to live or die, basically.
Yeah. And he makes that choice. And then, again, she just shoots him in the leg because he's kind of a dope. He does not think, he can't even think of there being this other choice. She shoots him in the leg and then sends him off to jail with Samuel Jackson doing a cameo as a guy who's really good at breaking out of jail, which is like a fun, happy ending.
Kind of the perfect
ending.
Yeah,
yeah, okay, we love it.
Because she had to do her job and she got to do her job. Yep. And that's the one kind of cool thing about Karen Sisko is she had her time out, but she's still in pursuit of him. And not, you know, they leave it sort of ambiguous, like is it because she loves him? But no, she's a federal marshal that's like good at her job.
Yeah, and it's like she... Meanwhile, like mixed in too with like all this real stuff, there's one of the hardest I've ever laughed in a movie. The point I can remember it now 20 years later is when White Boy Bob slips on a frozen steak and shoots himself in the head.
Oh, God.
It is the most.
Clooney's reaction afterwards.
It is so fucking shocking
because
it's this big climactic thing and he's got this gun on him. He's like, this is where the climax happens.
Uh-huh.
And he slips on a frozen steak,
falls,
and just shoots himself in the head. And they live in this beat of looking at Clooney's face and the movie just continues on.
That end is so violent too. And, and it's weird. Most like there's the, I mean, I guess there's a couple of scenes of violence, but the Steve Zahn thing is all off camera.
Off camera.
And so that end is kind of shocking when that gunplay starts.
The only other thing that I think really hints towards it, and I think it's, again, a really smart choice, is Cheadle shanks a guy in prison.
Right.
And it's pretty bad. Like the sound, like it's not gory, but the sound gets you. And it is a way of going, okay, there's Ving Rhames and there's Clooney and there's Zahn.
Yeah.
Snoopy's something different.
Yeah.
And so then when we get to that end, they're doing that, like we can sort of like, I think we buy that he's always been this way. But even he's also still funny. That there's that whole sequence with them just admiring the suits and trying to figure out how to open a safe. God. And it's very funny.
Yeah, when they – I mean, it's funny. Like, I don't know anything about safes, but when you take one look at that safe and they're pointing their guns at it, you're like, there's no way they're going to fucking blow that door off.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, someone that's going to ricochet off and kill one of them is what's going to happen. Yeah. Which I'm surprised it didn't, actually. Yeah.
He crushes the fish, too, which is also really gross.
Yeah.
Like, that always stuck with me as being, like, what a sociopathic thing to do to have a fish in a bag.
Yeah, and but like, he's small time, though. Like, he even says early on, he says when I came in here on credit card fraud, he's like, I wasn't very well respected.
Yeah.
He's like, but ever since I shanked that guy, he's like, my stock has gone up, basically.
Yeah.
My Dun and Broad Street.
Yeah. Because he had been known for throwing fights.
Yeah,
he
that
would
was
be a boxer.
Deal.
Yeah, uh-huh. And then he'd throw fights and
that
just make
scene
money
is so funny.
It.
That look on his face when he's boxing that guy. He's kind of like,
little nudge.
All right, now, like, you gonna hit me?
It's also where, like, that movie, you can see some of the. I love Ocean's 11. My wife and I,
same.
For the last few years, hosted a similar show to this at UCB where we would just talk to someone about a movie they love and then watch it.
Yeah, what show is that?
It's called Required Viewing. This is it. We're actually wrapping it up because we got 10-month-old now. It's real tough.
Oh, you're
get
not
it
doing
out.
It anymore?
It's literally Sunday.
I never
it's
got
the
to
last
be on.
One. I know.
I'm so sad.
You messaged me. I was like, oh, man. What horrible timing.
Yeah.
But we did with Demi Didjouie-Bey last month did Ocean's 11.
Uh-huh.
And like that in Traffic, you can see the DNA that of the stuff he was working on in Out of Sight. Like the color schemes of Miami versus Detroit in Out of Sight, he just brings over the Traffic to help you keep the different storylines straight.
Yeah, for sure.
Miami is warm and orange and Detroit is cold and blue. And he does a lot of that. And then some of that little, like, those editing, he goes nuts with that in Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
Like all the wipes and the, that sort of thing. And it works really well. But it feels like Out of Sight was, wait, I have real money to make a movie?
Yep.
And I can still do what I want to do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's figure it out.
Yeah.
And then since then, every time he's had budget, he's been extending and playing with those ideas.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons Soderbergh has always just been one of my favorites is the just his range. Like, he does all those indie films at the beginning, which were – I was just such a fan. And then Out of Sight was the first one where, you know, it was different. It was flashy.
Yeah.
And it had style, and it had that score is so great.
Oh, yeah, that Dave Holmes
and
score.
I was like, what is going on with Soderbergh?
Yeah.
Like, where's he headed from here? And then Aaron Brockovich comes out, which was just this, like, gut-wrenching character piece.
Yeah.
And then, like, he comes back and does stuff like Oceans and Traffic, which was just like, holy shit.
They're all covering
stuff. Like, at the top of his game.
And Oceans 11 is I think, a, like, that is what in, like, a Just World popcorn movies would be.
Totally.
Understand, like, it's beautiful people being fun, and it's a grown-up popcorn movie. And I really like Marvel movies. I like all this. You know, I'm not judging that, but it's...
When that's all you're getting.
Yeah, and it shows you how hard it is to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Plenty of people, like, there have been a shit ton of people trying to do their Ocean's 11 cents, and they don't work.
Yeah.
But that movie is just, like, pure crowd-pleasing. You know? And Aaron Brockovich is a different type of crowd-pleaser. Right? There's like more depth to it, but it is still being like, fuck yeah, like, you know, we're going to fix this. But then mixed in with that, we've got The Limey, which you're never going to be like, oh, and here's our tent pole.
Yeah.
And even Traffic, which is a very like serious movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like Brockovich is serious but fun. Oceans is just fun.
Yeah.
But Traffic is something different.
Yeah.
And then he's kind of continued in that, like he did Logan Lucky last year, 2 years ago.
You know what, man? I liked Logan Lucky.
I liked Logan Lucky.
I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it in the top five Soderbergh movies,
no,
but it was like,
but it was certainly worth watching.
And I think I was like, this is what I want more mid-budget movies like this, where it's like, like a heist at a racetrack. Like, this is a great premise. There are things I don't like about it and things I really like about it.
It's like when we were growing up, those were, like if you go back and look at any given week in the 1980s, it was just flooded with
so many of those
good movies like that.
And like plenty of bad ones too, but it's you like by, I know what it is. It's because how are you going to sell that overseas? How are you going to make $500 million off of that?
Yeah.
It's
become so like,
But there are, I mean, like all, I try to, when movies like that come out, go see them.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I'm like, I might not like this because I would like to be able to see Endgame and then the next week, Logan Lucky, or, you know, fingers crossed, Out of Sight. You know, I want both of those things, or Booksmart or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And we didn't even mention Contagion, which is...
Oh, I forgot about Contagion.
So good.
Yeah.
I'd totally forgotten about that movie, and we were recording a Stuff You Should Know the other day, and it came up, and I was like, oh, God, Contagion was so good.
Yeah.
So good. I have a lot of my favorite lines in here, and I don't want to just spin the show saying my favorite lines.
Yeah, let's do it.
But I'm going to pepper in some of them. But Steve Zahn, I see. You guys are cynical.
Yeah.
Is one of my faves.
It's one of the best, like,
he's one of my favorite characters in film history, probably, is
so
Glenn.
Funny. Glenn and just the with the sunglasses and the business he has. I think when you first meet him, maybe the second time you see him, when he's like, yeah, I got something big lined up back north. And he's like making his way down the weights in the workout place because he can't get any of them up.
Uh-huh.
And it's just business.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so funny.
Yeah.
And his just like that little drawl he does.
Oh, yeah. And it's like, you talk about the dumb criminals in this movie. I mean, Steve Zahn is the dumbest of all them. And I love the interplay between him and Jennifer Lopez.
Yeah.
How she's like, he's almost like a puppy to her.
Yeah.
She's not going to arrest him.
It's just pity and just embarrassment.
Yeah. And because she knows, like, this guy's way more valuable to me as someone I can just, like, milk information out of.
And his last scene, the scene with her, just like
in the car.
Yeah. It's just like, I already stole the car. How can I steal a car if I already stole it? Is so funny. And he's so upset because he murdered somebody. He thinks he's going to get murdered.
Yeah.
But it's still like, I truly watch that as like someone who like writes and directs and wants to make stuff that I like as much as I like that. And
yeah.
go like, I don't know how you do it where you juggle those things.
Right.
Because maybe I don't have the confidence in myself that, oh, I can do both these things. I have no idea how you make those things work so close to each other. Because in that same scene, Jennifer Lopez is dealing with the fact like, I might have to shoot this guy that I just spent the night with and that I am like falling in love with.
Right.
And they're in character-wise, they're in two different movies in their own heads. And she knows, he has no idea.
Uh-huh.
And the movie works. Oh, it's so great.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a bit of a magic trick, but it is Steven Soderbergh.
Yes.
Don't like be too hard on yourself. Another great scene early on is the library scene with the fish when he's shaking down Albert Brooks' character.
Yeah.
And the fish were like $2,000, now $3,000.
Yeah.
And Brooks is just like – and, you know, once George Clooney starts advising him, he's like, this is the dumbest shakedown. You should tell him to fuck off. And he's like, $500 for a pillow. And he's like, oh, that does seem a little high.
Yeah. So meek. And that scene, too, ends with like the guy in the cage banging to let them know that security's coming.
Uh-huh.
Right after he hit Snoopy's buddy in the face with a huge book.
Yeah.
And they all just cluster around the book and they're just reading through and be like, oh, yeah, sorry, we got all riled up. And
well, there's some really good prison shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really – and against – while still like being – he never drops the stakes while remaining fun. And that's what gets me is a lot of times it's like, oh, man, this movie is just a – it's just a blast. Like Ocean's 11 is just a blast.
Right.
Or it's serious. And in this movie, it's like, I think I can do both.
Uh-huh.
And he did it. Like that's – that I love.
Yeah. I mean, you can definitely see the DNA of this in Ocean's, but Ocean's was just fun.
Just fun.
And this had a lot more going on.
Which is not a knock on it. Like that's what they set out to do. And
for
sure. It's a blast.
For sure. We didn't even mention when we were going over the cast, the great, great Louis Guzman.
Oh, yes.
Who doesn't have...
You are mean is such a funny line read.
That's what I have in here. You are mean.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when he gets taken down and while he's getting handcuffed, he wants to know the secret to the sawed in half magic trick.
Yeah.
Fake legs?
Is it Keener? Is that...
Catherine Keener,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Another great, like, character actor.
And she's in, like, two scenes.
Yeah.
She's so good.
Yeah. Fake legs?
I think one of my favorite lines and is like the moment where you're like, she's richer than God and very successful, so good for her, but I wish this is where Jennifer Lopez's career ticker was. She's trying to track them down. She's trying to find Don Cheadle, so she goes to like his friends.
Yeah.
And this dude always wears like this weird like fireman jacket.
Oh, yeah. What's his name? Washington?
Is it?
Yeah, his last name's Washington. Yeah. He's great.
And he's the most threatening person there.
Yeah, for sure.
And she sits down with him and he's all threat and he's basically being like, basically saying, I want to fuck you and like in a very gross way. And she's just like, okay. And he's telling this long-winded story about his dead dog, about
Tuffy.
they should get down on the street, on the floor, and they used to tussle.
Yeah.
And then he like looks at her and is like, you like to tussle? I bet you like the bone, like that sort of stuff. And she's like, okay. And she stands up to leave and he grabs her and she like in one move pulls out this like baton, like breaks his arm, knocks him down. And
hits him in the eye.
Uh-huh. Hits him in the eye, yep. And has this line of like, you want to tussle? We tussle. And then puts the baton away and it freeze frames on her. And it is so cool. Like she looks like
such a badass.
That should launch franchise after franchise.
Yeah.
Because she became a world famous musician. I'm sure that the money's better, but.
Well, she became J-Lo. Yeah.
And then,
no looking back after that.
And that high collared leather jacket.
Yeah, man. She looked great and was tough and
so
smart.
Cool.
Yeah. Like, I mean, she was the smartest person in the movie.
The only smart. It's her and Albert Brooks are the only half intelligent people.
Albert Brooks is. You like to get down on the floor and tussle like Tuffy. another one of my favorite lines is from Clooney when he goes to meet Ridley and he gets offered the security guard job and he goes, you were ice cream for freaks in prison. You were a dumpling.
Yeah.
It's just like to type those words, you were ice cream for freaks.
Yeah. You go like, this will sound like a human being when they say like,
I mean, that had to be Leonard, right?
I would That does sound like something that would come straight from Leonard. Like,
yeah, like straight from the book.
There's also Cheadle has a line I love when they're taking Zahn to go murder this person. And like Zahn's like, no, it's my deal, man. Blah, blah, blah. And he goes, I think it's in the scene, and he goes, a situation like this has a high potentiality for a motherfucker to bitch out.
Yeah.
And it just rolls off his tongue in a way that I don't do justice to.
Oh, man.
But it's so, like, there's so much character in that of, like,
yeah.
He's trying to sound big enough, but, like,
yeah.
The situation like this has high potentiality for a common motherfucker to bitch yeah. out. It's like, what is – this line is incredible, and he's right. all over the map on it.
Yeah.
And he's great. It's so fun.
Yeah. Yeah. He – God, I feel so bad for Glenn in this movie because
oh, yeah.
God, he's the biggest dimwit of them all. Mm-hmm. And you know, when he's in the car, he's stole that car.
Yeah.
And Don Cheadle's just like, no, man.
Yeah.
You know, if I say this is my car, this is my car.
Yeah.
Just go steal another one. And there's nothing he can do about it.
Yeah. He's just a big mouth who like
yeah.
found out about this thing because another big mouth, Albert Brooks, told him.
Yeah.
And then that got all these other people involved.
Like, how did he survive prison, that guy?
Also, I think too, like, we don't. He is a less flashy role, but Ving Rhames
is great.
Also in one of his more like restrained,
uh-huh.
like not crazy roles.
Yeah.
Like, and he's just this like super loyal, nice guy.
Yeah, he's the conscience of the film in a lot of ways.
The reason Jack Foley went away from jail is because every time he just breaks a law, he calls his sister and
right.
confesses, but he wanted to get ahead of it. So Ving Rhames wanted to get ahead of it, so he called his sister before they
yeah.
did the job and they got picked up. And they're still friends.
Yeah.
Like, that's really fun and lovely.
It is. They're very sweet with
yeah.
each other. And they are good guys. Like,
yeah.
at the end, they could have gone away at the end of the Ridley robbery. But, you know, they're sitting in the van and Clooney goes, they're going to rape that housekeeper.
Yeah.
And they're going to kill Ridley.
Yeah.
And, you know, he knew what he had to do.
And he goes back in.
And like, knowing he's either going to die
yeah.
or go to jail.
There's a thing that Leonard does in a lot of his books that I really, really love where, like, it's almost always overreach that tears these
yeah.
people down. Like, there's one of my favorite Omar Leonard books is called Swag.
Mm-hmm.
And the hook of it is it would be a great movie, is this guy steals a car from a dealership
mm-hmm.
and gets caught when the dealership owner just sees him do it. And he goes to jail. But then in trial, the guy owns the dealer goes like, oh, never mind, I want press charges, it's fine. Finds him later and goes, hey, I think I've come up with the foolproof way to rob places where you won't get caught. I have
right.
10 steps. And they drink together and they go over and they go, okay, and they start doing that. And the first half of the book is them like following these rules and it works. And then the guy just gets a big head and he
uh-huh.
starts breaking one rule after the other and like to get a little bit greedy.
Yeah.
And of course they end up get caught and it falls into violence. But like that inevitable progression of
uh-huh.
a bad idea that you think is smart.
Yeah.
And then you don't know to not push it.
Right.
And then it falls, like that's sort of the pattern of his books. And Out of Sight does that really well.
For sure.
Even without the time jumping's there. But it's they yeah. don't need these diamonds.
Right.
But they're gonna fucking do it.
Yeah.
And like that results in a bunch of people dead.
Yeah.
And him going back to jail.
Yeah, I mean, the whole time you're watching this, you want Clooney to walk away from it all, but
yeah.
he even has the line, it's that trope. He says to Ving, he says, have you ever known anyone that did the one big job and
yeah.
then walked away from it all?
Yeah.
He's like, that doesn't happen. Like guys mm-hmm. like us go until we get caught.
Yep.
And then we go again until we get caught. And then eventually we go until we die.
And he tries, like when we realize what the first scene is, that first robbery where he just smooth talks to the
yeah.
robbery. That right before that is when he goes and he tries to go straight.
Yeah.
And ego doesn't let him, but also Ripley being a dick doesn't let him.
Right.
And so he freaks out and,
yeah.
and he snaps and he goes back inside and then he tries to rob this bank and he goes back into prison.
Yeah.
And I love that moment so much because it tells you everything you need to know about him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, it's ego and yes, it's him, but also it's like, what the fuck am I going to do?
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to wear these khaki shorts and stand as a security guard at a
right.
bank.
Right. Although Ridley is right.
Yeah.
Like, seeing it. I hadn't seen it in a while, and seeing it like with a few years under my belt in that scene, I was like, Ridley's right. He's not going to let this guy walk in and give him some great job. Cause
yeah.
what does Ridley say? He's like, I will give you the good job. He's like, you'll get it. He's like, but you got to show me first. You got to
yeah.
earn it and show me that you can change. And I was watching it on the plane on the way here, I was like, oh, fuck, man, he's right on the money. That's exactly how he should do
it. His mistake is that, like, rich guy attitude of being like, I'm better than you. You know what I mean? Like, and that's the, and that sends Foley off.
Yeah.
Because there's a way to make that argument of being like, okay, and you might be able to get Foley, but he does that, like, powerful rich guy. He played that role. He based on like Michael Milken.
Who's
like a
I remember that guy.
Yeah, like an inside a trader got busted and everything. And like that's what they based that version of that character on. Like right over to that the hair thing. That's like what he would wear. Yeah, like till you see him and you're like, oh yeah, I see it absolutely. But, like I love that little like everyone has an angle that never becomes shtick.
Right.
Like, every single character has a thing that's weird and makes them pop, but it's never being like, well, I always have a puppet, you know, like it's always just enough that you can tag it and like talk about improv a bunch, but like I think about that sort of stuff a lot, like in comedy and improv of being like, you'll have your thing, but you also have to be able to be a normal person. Even if you're the weird one in the scene, if the context changed, you have to also be able to order a sandwich.
Right.
And like, that's what they all have is being like, Steve Zahn is so fucking dumb that I believe he could order a hamburger if he needed to.
Right.
And like, so you're like, okay, then I accept this world.
Oh, interesting. I never really thought about it that way. That's good stuff. So the very end, you know, I think he had to leave you with some hope.
Yeah.
Like, because the core of this film isn't the crime stuff. It's like this relationship.
Yeah.
And this weird thing where they're like, she's shown a history of falling in love with the wrong guys, first of all, because she falls in love with, or she's at least dating
Ray Nicolette.
Ray Nicolette.
She's a very good Elmer Leonard name.
Who Farina, I haven't done Midnight Run in here, by the way. This is also one of my favorite movies ever. Speaking of Farina, R.I.P. But he says that, you know, he's married.
Yeah.
And like he kind of makes reference to the fact that she's continually falling in love with the wrong guys. And then when she's talking to her superior, who she totally puts in his place, which is great. That's a great scene.
Yes.
Have you ever been primary through the door?
Yeah.
But he says something about the fact that she dated a bank robber before, right?
Yeah. There's something like that where like – or someone who –
But she shot him.
Yeah. Like,
which is total foreshadowing, of course.
What happens. Yeah. I always forget about that. That like, so there's someone else.
So she's always falling for the wrong guy.
Wrong guys.
But Clooney's kind of the right guy.
Yeah. And he's like, and he's different. You know what I mean? Like he's not a bad, like, again, he's a loser. He's not a bad boy. You know, like it's not that sort of thing. He's just this, I think probably that trunk scene, he's so dopey and excitable and puppyish. Like, that like she ends up being like, okay, well, this isn't the sort of person I'm normally like sending to jail.
Yeah.
And then they kind of fixate on each other. And it's so like, again, like that bar scene, I think is one of the most like romantic and sexy scenes I've ever seen.
For sure.
Because it's not just
so much heat in that scene.
And there's no nudity and it's romantic.
Yeah.
Like them sitting there with that snow falling and the moment where he snaps out of like that sort of like, let's pretend we're different people and go, how long are we gonna go on with this? And she looks so sad that they can't just keep doing it for a little while.
Yeah.
And then when it starts intercutting with them back in the room and it's freeze framing and she's taking off the dress and he's like bumbling around kind of.
Yeah.
It is just like there are very few scenes like that stick with me to the degree that scene sticks with me.
Yeah. And then the next day, the next morning, that scene is really great.
Yeah.
When he talks about, you know, the fact that she's smart. He's like, why would you think that I thought you were dumb?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's
like the way they played that was really great.
And it is, and a big part of it is, you know, the script is great and Soderbergh is great, but, you know, Clooney and Lopez are so good. And I really don't think it can be said enough about how much in 98 that sort of performances from them would not be.
Yeah. It's hard to kind of remember back
before
they were like these superstars
where it's just sort of like, cause it's small and it's grounded and
it's
pretty egoless she looks really cool, but like for both of them, they're like, in it. You don't feel the vanity sometimes you get from super famous people being on TV,
right.
Especially when George Clooney is one of the most famous people in the world.
Yeah.
You don't get a glimmer of that.
Yeah,
and I actually think George Clooney in general has really good taste and stuff.
Sure.
He's clearly a smart guy, but I think it took Soderbergh to get him to be like, hey, let's open up this thing. And
he's
like, oh, okay, yeah, you're right. I'm not hunky doctor. I'm something else.
Yeah, and he was pre-attached when Soderbergh got it, but they went on to work together
Yeah.
kind of right afterward. They did the Solaris remake,
yeah,
which wasn't great.
Yeah.
But
oh boy.
Again, reaching for the, like, swinging for the fences.
Absolutely.
It's like, you're not going to fault Soderbergh for remaking Solaris.
Because it's never going to be like, oh, you made a movie that, like, I fully just forgot about the second I watched it. It'll be like,
right,
I didn't enjoy that.
Yeah.
But it's never going to be like, oh, Soderbergh did that?
Right.
It's always going to be like, when you if it's a movie you didn't like, you're going to be like, yeah, that was a Soderbergh movie.
Because
it's always, and it always looks,
yeah,
like he, there's that thing people pass around every now and again on social media, but like that idea of, he was talking about Fury Road and how, like, he still pulls apart other movies to try and figure out how people did it.
Oh, interesting.
And he wrote this wonderful thing about how, like, I don't know how George Miller did it. Like,
oh, really?
It's, I cannot do this. I can't figure out. I've watched this so many times and tried to pull apart. But just, like...
So he stumped Soderbergh?
Yeah. And I admire that so much, of being like, he could fucking coast. He could make anything he wanted. He could make big movies, just get rich, rich, rich. But he's still going, I'm going to pull apart this movie that I enjoyed because I need to understand how it works.
Right.
And, like, true nerddom there.
Yeah.
But, like, I find that so goddamn admirable.
Yeah.
And I think that's what leads to him doing things like, was it Mosaic? What was that, like, weird?
I didn't see it. Was that the iPhone one? Or
that was the one that was, like, on, I think, HBO, and then also on,
oh,
there's an
right.
app and everything. I might be
with Sharon Stone?
I forget who was in, because I didn't.
I think I know what you're talking about, and I did not see that.
But it was like, that's an experiment that can only come from someone like constantly learning.
Right.
And I think that is incredible to have made. I think things are basically masterpieces, and be like, and I still am not done learning is.
Yeah.
Not a lot of dudes are able, dudes in particular, to let the ego go enough, I think.
Yeah, I think that. You're right. And, you know, I think he said he was retiring and then just immediately
started. Yeah, what are you talking about? Why would I do that? I'm going to make this weird movie about dolls.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't see that one either. Bubble?
Bubble, yeah, that was what it was.
Yeah, there's a few of his. I mean, just because it's who he is, I think I owe it to him to see everything.
A lot. Sometimes there'll be stuff that I was like, oh, he's doing that? I was like, man, I'm glad he did that. And I probably won't get around to it.
Right.
But like, like, that's kind of my take of, like, so cool that he did that sort of thing. But also, you know.
Yeah. Only so much time.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, so the end that, you know, you have to end it on that hopeful ending because the undercurrent of their relationship, like, you want them to be together, but you don't necessarily want to see them riding off into the sunset.
Yeah.
Like,
feels fault. Like, she lets Glenn run away.
Yeah.
And that last shot of him just running through the snows, he's so pathetic. But, like, once they get to the house and all these people have been murdered and everything, like, the movie wouldn't work if she was like, get out of here.
Right.
Or like, and then we'll run away to a beach.
Yeah. No one wants to see that.
But he, and it's not true to him. He has to go to jail. He's a loser. He has to go to jail.
Yep.
But that optimism of maybe he's probably going to break out again.
Right.
Because he keeps breaking out of jails is like such a great van just drives away.
Oh, and it's like, Sam Jackson. And it's just the way they play it, you know, like how many times? He's like 9 times he broke out of jail. And then that just shot of her kind of grinning.
Yeah.
It's like she orchestrated this whole thing.
So great. Yeah, she kept him in that jail for a week to put them together.
Yeah.
And it's great.
Oh,
so
man.
So fun.
So good. You got anything else?
About the movie?
Yeah.
Hours and hours. But the absolutely. There's one other moment that I love so much, and it's the elevator moment. It's right before they go to Detroit.
That.
Like, the music in the movie is great. Dave Holmes did the score, but it's also got a bunch of great stuff, and there's some Isley Brothers song.
Yeah.
And they hard cut to Detroit, and it's Isley Brothers' Fight the Power, which is a great song, and it comes in hard. But there's a moment right before that where they're, like, they're in this hotel in Miami, and Ving Rhames is trying to be like, we got to get out of here, And he's like, oh, I want to see her one more time. And they're going down to the car, and these sort of, like, chauvinistic cops are like, okay, we figure out where they are. We're going to go up and
take the stairs.
Yeah, you have to Jennifer Lopez's character, to Karen Sisko, wait and watch the lobby, which is, like, the shit job.
Right.
This is my case. There's a whole thing about it. So they go down, and as these cops are taking the stairs up, and the doors open so this little old lady can get off, and it takes forever. And Clooney looks up and sees her, and she's on the couch, and she sees him, and they just stare at each other. And as the door is closed, he just does this little nerdy wave.
Yeah.
And the doors close. And she goes, I saw her. She's in the lobby. And Ving Rhames is like, what? And they're like, okay, let's go to Detroit. And
yeah.
They hard cut out. But just that, her just watching him, and that little wave is.
And then it cuts back to her and she's just still sort of frozen.
Yeah, just she freezes up. Yeah. And it's another way of showing one of those, like, kind of like timeouts, I think.
Yeah.
But it's so fucking fun where she like lets him go, but it doesn't feel, it just feels like, what do I I've got 10 impulses right now.
It felt real.
Yeah. And it's so.
And the way he played it was just so great.
Yeah.
And that part actually reminded me of the very first bank robbery scene. It has that great moment where he's robbing the girl and he's just being so charming. And he tells her, have a nice day. And she goes, you too.
Yeah.
And she like catches herself like.
So befuddled.
With the customer service still.
There's another one. Talking about the ending too and having to have that nice ending. There's a great moment where he fakes it out early on.
Uh-huh.
Where like after the first robbery and she's like on to him and they escape in the trunk and everything. And they're in Miami. And it cuts with like no hint that something different is coming.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
I know what you're talking about.
Clooney's taking a bath with these candles around him.
Yeah, yeah.
And Karen Sisko's coming down the hall alone with a gun. And she's going to bust him. She comes in and he's in the tub. And she climbs into the tub with him.
Yeah.
And I remember when I saw in the theater, like in the 20s, I remember people going like, what?
Yeah.
Because it feels like a bullshit Hollywood thing to have happen.
For sure.
And a very like dude centric, like she gets in the tub,
yeah,
and it cuts, and it's a dream sequence. It's her waking up.
It's her fantasy,
fantasy, because she's been in like a coma,
right?
Because she got into a car accident with idiot Steve Zahn, and that's all that was.
Yeah,
and I think that is kind of a way of going like, we're not. Don't worry.
Yeah.
We're not doing this in this movie.
Right.
Because it sells it. Like they've done all these time jumps and it's treated the same way. So you're like, oh, this is not. What human being does is go, oh, none do.
Right.
It's just like a fever dream she's having.
Well, and it's a bit of misdirection in that it wasn't his fantasy.
Yeah.
So it's the first sort of indicator like that he is on her mind.
Yeah.
Like they're both sort of obsessed with each other.
Yeah.
Like he calls her on the phone.
That's
when she's sitting there with Dennis Farina and Michael Keaton. She's like, give me 5 minutes. Yeah, she steps out. Because, and you know, when Bing Rames brings over the newspaper, oh, is Karen in there? Does it say what she's doing now? I mean, he's like a little schoolboy almost.
It's such like a high school crush sort of thing. And it's so
fun. It's
very
sweet.
And then while that scene's going on, also there's the great like Dennis Farina just dismantling Michael Keaton. Like I love Michael Keaton because he's such like a – he's willing to look the fool so much, and he's just this cocky, gum-chewing piece of shit.
Yeah.
And it's just Dennis Farina very confidently holding eye contact and just basically calling him out for cheating on his wife. And it's a shame we never got a movie with just those two people.
Yeah.
Just like headlining it.
Yeah,
and Farina. That would have been a delight.
I was a PA on a TV commercial out here in the early 2000s, and we were shooting in this neighborhood in Brentwood. And you know how it is on set. Like everyone's just sort of hanging out outside while they're shooting inside. This Porsche wheels around the corner and parks, not doesn't park, like just stops sort of sideways, half in the street, half in the driveway. Michael Keaton jumps out to check his mail. And it was such an egregious, like, there's someone shooting across the street from me.
Yeah.
I'm going to Keaton this thing up and jump out like to check the mail in the most like obnoxious way possible. And he entertained us all for 10 minutes. I was like, Michael Keaton's down there. And he kind of gave the nod of like, come on down, PAs.
Yeah.
And he just sort of talked to us for 10 minutes.
And
he was
so
like
great.
The nicest guy. And this was a while ago, like before the big comeback. But like, you know, to us, he was Beetlejuice and he was Batman, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
He's like one of the biggest stars in the world.
And also one of the most like I sometimes you're like, I get why George Clooney like fills the frame. And like, again, watching Ocean's 11, Julia Roberts has like a nothing part. And when she's on screen, you're looking at her. Like she's such a goddamn movie star.
Yeah.
And you watch Michael Keaton, you're like, why can't I not watch you? Like, if you're on screen, I'm looking at you and it's like, and I can't put my finger on what it is about him. There's that scene in that like a Spider-Man movie where like that scene, the best scene in the movie people talk about where he figures it out.
Right.
And he's driving them to the dance
and
in the back seat. And he's not doing a lot.
Yeah.
And you're just getting reams of information off of him. And
yeah.
He's a gorgeous, just his self-confidence is stunning. Like, and that's why Beetlejuice works too, because that's a different version of like, what if I do it all?
Right.
What if I go to 100?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm blown away by someone who's like, I can be Beetlejuice.
Right.
I can play these things small. He tends to
or
like things
big. Or I can
be
Mr. Mom.
Yeah, of course. The most grounded of small characters. What if a dad had to clean?
I'm so nervous about the Beetlejuice sequel.
I
think they're still doing it.
I know. I would imagine the musical will help. Like that, like Anthony King. Like he's a very talented writer, an UCB guy. Like wrote and
oh really?
Like, and I want to see the set looks incredible.
I'm sure.
But it seems like it's changed. It's not just here's the movie.
Right.
It seems like thematically connected more. But like I would be – that Beetlejuice Goes to Hawaii thing that they kept almost making in the early 90s.
Oh, yeah,
That was like the original sequel they wanted to do.
Was it?
Like, it was like he – I don't know how. Well, I don't know what exactly it was, but like Beetlejuice Goes to Hawaii was the hook of it. And it does – it works so well just living alone.
Yeah.
Because I think of the Dietzes, because of the Dietzes and the Maitlands.
Right.
Like they are the movie.
Yeah,
Beetlejuice is such a small part. And I'd be like, what are they going to do in a sequel that isn't just Beetlejuice wall-to-wall? Because I don't really want to see 90 minutes of Beetlejuice the character.
I
want Lydia to cut it.
Yeah, yeah. I never really thought about that. That was sort of the secret sauce of that movie.
Yeah. Because, I mean, some of the funniest stuff in that movie – is, I mean, like Catherine O'Hara is a worldwide treasure.
Yeah.
And like everything she does is just so good.
Have you ever worked with her?
Oh, gosh, no. When I was at Funny or Die, there were some people I was constantly chasing.
Oh, really?
And she was one of them. But I think she lives in Canada, so I could never get her.
Who else?
The weirdest person, I would always try and get David Byrne for something, but he lived in New York when we were here. The weirdest thing that I tried for years, the whole time I was there was I wanted to do a video with Patty Duke.
Oh, wow.
And I wanted to do Grey Gardens, but with her as the two Patty Dukes from the Patty Duke show, which, and like, to be fair, this new media streaming comedy company in 2011 wasn't like, let's do a video about a 1960s sitcom.
Right.
The only other reference point is a 1970s documentary. Like, it was a hard sell. Also, and then also to Patty Duke, who I did get them to, like, reach out a couple times. I'm not sure the will you do a free Funny or Die video really hit with, like, an 80-year-old woman who was like, what? No.
Right. It's funny that I'm like, she could either be totally game for that or just totally
confused.
You never
know. And I think it was just sort of like, I'm sure whoever her people are were all sort of like, yeah, we'll run it by her. And then, no, but I still, that was like my.
Is she still with us?
No, she passed away a couple years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
Because I inexplicably loved Patty Duke as a kid.
Really?
Despite not being 80 years old.
Patty Duke show?
Like, it was on Nick at Night. And I was like, Patty Duke.
Yeah,
I was
man.
Like, F Troop and the Patty Duke show.
Oh, God, I loved F Troop.
Yeah.
So good. Larry Storch?
Storch, yeah.
Yeah, man. He's the best.
There's something, I actually think you could remake F Troop and have it work. There are some very culturally insensitive things with Native Americans.
Sure.
But the core idea of both sides are pretending to be at war just so that their bosses don't fuck with them is very funny.
It is.
And I think you could update that and have it be great.
Totally. All right, man. We finish every episode with five questions.
Great.
What is the first movie you saw in the movie theater?
Oh, my goodness. You know, it might be Stop Making Sense.
My
parents took me to see Stop Making Sense. I don't remember it, but they have stories of me dancing in the aisles. I still love talking to this day. But so I think probably because that would have been 84, so I would have been two or three. So Stop Making Sense, I think, is probably it.
Did you see that last David Byrne tour?
Yeah, American Utopia.
Yeah.
Oof, that was good. That was one of the best shows I've ever seen.
Same.
I've seen him a bunch because I just love talking so much, and I like some of his solo stuff, but that tour, like legit inspired me.
Yeah, same. My wife and I went to that, and I had a couple of moments, one where I literally almost passed out from euphoria.
Did you see it in Atlanta?
Yeah.
I think my mom was at that show. I bought her tickets. When I saw it, I was like, my mom's going to love this, and she lives in Atlanta. And
oh,
so
no way.
I was like,
what part of Atlanta?
Like Sandy Springs.
Okay.
Yeah, so I got her tickets.
Yeah, man, I was there, so I almost passed out from euphoria. Little booze, little weed.
Sure.
But during Once in a Lifetime, and there was this, the music and the spectacle, everything just like got to, you know that live show thing where you sort of leave your body.
Yeah.
That happened, and I almost fainted.
Huh.
And I'm not a fainter.
Yeah.
So that, and then just leaving, just thinking like this guy in his, I guess, 60s.
Yeah.
Like still innovating to that level. Was so just so fucking inspiring.
Stagecraft was, I don't get, I don't like freak out around famous people that much just because I think of like they're on UCB and
sure.
like Funny or Die. I just met incredibly famous people. And so I'm pretty calm, but like that doesn't apply to musicians.
Oh, yeah.
And like if I'm going to melt down, it's going to be around a musician. And like I got to meet him once after a show and I just like, Dick Van Dyke bumbled my way trying to, and like, so like when I melt down, it's always like someone, it's like,
yeah,
I'm in a room with Carrie Brownstein and
right.
I love Slater Kinney and I can't function.
Yeah.
And like he was the the most bumbling I've ever been in a room with, because, and like, he's a weirdo. He didn't.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay. Like,
you know, Corin Tucker and Lance Bangs were at Max Fun a couple of years ago. And I was sort of the same way. I was like, I sort of unfringed new Lance somehow. And so I went up and said hi to him, and Corin came up, and I was just like, oh my God. And she was like, oh, Chuck, she was like, my family loves Stuff You Should Know. We listen to it in the car, me and my kids. And I was like, are you kidding me? And she's like the nicest lady and a mom and a wife. And I'm like, you know, she's great. They're, like, we'd be pals.
Yeah. I love that band so much, and they're so smart and human and great and wonderful. And I can't wait for the new album. But like, I would assume that they would be very nice to interact with.
Yeah.
Similarly, like, I truly love Ted Leo and Ted Leo and the Pharmacist, and I've like a lot. I've never met him, but I have a lot of mutual friends with him. And I've been in places.
He's going to Max Fun tomorrow.
Is he?
Yeah.
So he's another one where I just like, I've been in places with him, and I just kind of like stare at the floor because, like, some of those albums meant like so much to me during part, like, tough times in my life and everything. And like, so I just go like, I can't. I will melt down if I try to talk
that
to you.
That is literally going to be me tomorrow.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the cabin hang that happens after everything.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Leo is going to be with us, and I'm just going to be like,
If I were there, I would not talk to him. I would not. I would spend however long is going on wanting to and not being able to think of anything worthwhile saying.
I've met him two or three times over the years through mutual friends, and every time he says, like, it's nice to meet you, and I never have the you know, what are you going to say? Like, oh, no, you've met me before.
Me.
Yeah. You're like, I'm the guy you never remember.
I got distracted because there's
a
dog above us.
Oh, there is?
The floor above us on the ceiling is the glass floor. The dog ran across.
I didn't even know that.
Interesting.
Boy, we got sidetracked there.
Get the dog back up. Creep on that dog some more.
I do have to say, though, through your Facebook, the thing I always I sort of love reading your feed because of your music stuff.
Oh,
you always do the end of the year, like, favorite albums and stuff.
Yeah.
And I always know I'm going to find, like, good new stuff.
Oh, thanks.
Through you, because I've just in the last couple of years, I've gotten to the point where I'm not discovering as much new stuff anymore.
Yeah.
Which is like,
it's hard.
I was like, nah, man, I'm always going to be getting the new bands. And even though, like, I'm 48 and they're like 23, I'll go to those shows. And I did up until a couple of years ago, and I stopped discovering bands.
Me
except
too.
Through you and your end of year lists.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice.
That and your politics.
I don't post too much about politics.
Huh?
I do post too much about politics.
No, I think it's great because you're one of the few, you're one of the great liberals in my feed. That's
what my tattoo says. One of the great liberals.
That's doing it right. Like, I have a lot of friends that are liberals that are doing it wrong on Facebook and that I think are hurting the cause. And I think you do it right.
Oh, well, thank you.
So, well done.
That's very nice.
It's always reasoned and intelligent. And
honestly, I think it's that lack of that hatred of competition. Like, people be like screaming, be like, all right, that's fine. Scream away.
All right. Number two, first R-rated movie you saw, theater or home. And like, was that a thing for you? Was that a big deal?
At home, I'm not sure because I remember sleepover. I bet I just watched stuff with my parents. It didn't matter. Like, so like sleepovers, I mentioned Terminator 2, like that was early on. Also, for some reason in my fairly rural New Hampshire upbringing, like Boys in the Hood was really big in our like third and fourth grade class. Like if you got to see Boys in the Hood, that was like a big deal.
Wow.
So it was probably something like that.
Uh-huh.
And I remember in the theater seeing Die Hard with a Vengeance, which might have been the first R-rated movie I ever saw in a theater. I assume that's R-rated.
That was the Sam Jackson one,
that
right?
That was the Sam Jackson one.
That was good.
And the one that was originally a movie called Simon Says, and they're like, what if it's a Die Hard movie?
Right.
And every time they
really? Did that start out as a non-Die Hard?
It was just the premise of like a cop has to go over and solve these riddles, and then they just made it a Die Hard movie. So like, and if you watch, next time it's on TV and it's always on, watch it for the ham-fisted being like, well, this thing happened in L.A. Okay. And then they just go back to the movie.
Did they just wedge in Die Hard things?
They jam in these like weird references and then be like, and what if he's Hans Gruber's brother? And the movie does not care about that.
Right.
Like it's irrelevant. But they're like, yeah, we got to tie it in somehow.
That sort of makes sense now.
Yeah.
Will you walk out of a bad movie?
And
do you remember doing so recently?
I can't imagine what would make me walk out of a movie. Like,
right.
I don't think I've ever done it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Number four, Taylor to the guests. So since you're a director of comedy, what movie do you wish you would have directed? But that's kind of not fair. Who would be your dream, like, comedy duo to direct?
Oh.
Or not even duo, just...
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's interesting. The...
Living or Dead.
Sure, yeah. The... I'll give a couple of mini answers. One, the one that's terrifying to say because he is a genius director, but is, and we talked about much, is like Albert Brooks obviously is massive and wonderful and so fucking funny, but also like, I guess I wouldn't want to because how in my own head I'd be the whole time trying to tell Albert Brooks how to be fun. Like what a fucking nightmare that would be for me.
Right.
Oh, you know what? I love Flight of the Conchords so much, that show, yeah. And I find those guys so funny that I think that would be, if I could just pick anyone to like direct something with them, it'd probably be either or both of them.
That feels like something that could happen.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know, New Zealand.
Oh, okay. And then finally, movie going 101. What is your movie ritual? Where do you sit? What do you eat?
I almost always get popcorn uncravely. I tend to, like, I do a lot of the Arc Light here in LA for LA people know what it is, but there's also the theater, the Vista, that over, which
we've talked a lot about the Vista. Oh, what a wonderful theater. I used to live right around the corner from the Vista.
Love it, love it, love it. More leg room than I've ever seen in a movie theater.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Absolutely incredible. And I love that place so much. So, like, that was, like, going there normally in the middle and, front back wise, and then weirdly, I've noticed just recently, it's like you have to buy tickets. I err on the side of like to the left of the theater if I can't get dead center. Uh-huh. Like I'll always prefer that over the right, and I don't know why.
I kind of do too, actually.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's the way I enter.
Yeah,
and I just don't like going to the other side.
But like, because here there's so many places where you have to buy the seats
right
even
beforehand.
Then, so like, I'm thinking some part of my brain is going like, go left,
right.
And I'm like, I don't know what's pushing me. It might just be I started doing it, and then now it's like DNA baked in. But I don't know.
Right. Yeah. And popcorn.
Yeah, and always popcorn. Which I'm like, my wife makes fun of me because like I eat it. I don't understand how people eat popcorn without being horrifying popcorn monsters.
Right.
Like I shovel popcorn in my mouth and it's horrifying. And I'll be like, I'm not going to do that. And then I'll be like, I hate this. Like I hate eating it slowly. I don't enjoy it.
Yeah.
I'll just really shovel what is basically styrofoam into my mouth.
Right. All over your shirt.
My stomach hurts.
Right. Awesome, Alex. Thanks a lot, man.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
This is a lot of fun. All right, everyone. Hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Always fun to sit down and talk with Alex. I'm super sad that he has stopped his UCB movie show because I always wanted to be on it. But maybe he'll bring it back one day once his cute little 10-month-old baby grows up a little bit and they have more time on their hands. But we had a great time talking about Soderbergh and Out of Sight and the craft of directing and editing and directing actors. Really good insight from Alex. Check out Children's Hospital. Go see Convoy if you're ever in L.A. The shows are cheap, and UCB, that's the great thing, is you never ever have to spend more than a few bucks to get in, see some of the greatest comedy that you're ever going to see with Convoy. And support Alex in everything he does. I hope to see him get that TV show one day that we talked about. It would be great. I guarantee it. So big thanks to Alex, and thanks to you guys for listening. And until next time, why don't you get in a trunk with George Clooney? Because I sure would.
Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.